From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a veterinarian who treats hippos, elephants, rhinos, and other animals in the wild. Dr. William Karish works for the Wildlife Conservation Society. He'll tell us about his adventures in remote regions with dangerous animals and hostile militias. Then we'll discuss the impact of rebel wars on wildlife conservation with Dr. Craig Stanford, an anthropologist who studies rare mountain gorillas and chimpanzees at a national park in Uganda. It's the park where last March a group of Western tourists, as well as his field assistant, were kidnapped by members of the Hutu militia that committed genocide in Rwanda. Half of the tourists were massacred. Also today, Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by Ron Sexsmith. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton has released a plan he says will keep the Medicare system solvent until 2027, while providing seniors with a popular new benefit, coverage for prescription drugs. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton is offering voluntary drug coverage to all seniors, starting at a cost of $24 a month. Medicare recipients would get coverage for up to $2,000 worth of drugs a year. Low-income seniors would have their premiums subsidized by the government.
That is a major problem for millions and millions of seniors, and not just those with low incomes. Of the 15 million Medicare beneficiaries who lack prescription drug benefits today, nearly half are middle-class Americans.
President Clinton's plan would cost the government $118 billion over 10 years. 60% of that cost would come from savings in the Medicare program. The other 40% will come from the budget surplus. The president wants to devote 15% of the surplus, almost $800 billion, to shore up the Medicare program. Mara Liasson, NPR News, the White House.
Thousands of Serbs rallied today near Belgrade to demand the resignation of President Slobodan Milosevic. About 10,000 people turned out for the rally, which was called by Yugoslavia's main opposition coalition, called the Alliance for Change. The ultranationalist Serbian Radical Party denounced the rally, saying alliance leaders are helping Serbia's enemies, and particularly the United States. Some local officials and foreign television crews reported that police stopped them from going to the town where the rally was held, but dozens of reporters were able to attend the demonstration. European leaders are warning Turkey not to execute a Kurdish guerrilla leader. A Turkish court sentenced Abdullah Öcalan to death today for leading a 15-year armed struggle for a Kurdish homeland. He's blamed for the deaths of some 37,000 people. NPR's Edward Lifson reports from Berlin.
European cities with large Kurdish populations braced for violent demonstrations today when the Öcalan verdict was announced. But except for in Cyprus, where Kurds threw stones at the U.S. embassy, the demonstrations in Europe were mostly peaceful. That's a sharp contrast to last February when Öcalan was arrested. Then violence erupted across Europe, with four people killed demonstrating at the Israeli consulate in Berlin. Germany, which holds the European Union's rotating presidency, led a chorus of voices of European diplomats, telling Turkey that executing Öcalan would jeopardize that country's already shaky prospects for entering the European Union. No EU member nation uses the death penalty. Öcalan's death sentence will automatically go to an appeals court. Kurdish rebels in Germany vow that if their leader is executed, they will engage in reprisals. Some 2 million Turks and Kurds live in Germany. This is Edward Lifson, NPR News, Berlin.
The Dow gained 160 points today. This is NPR. An American missionary arrived in Moscow today after 7 months of captivity in Russia's breakaway region of Chechnya. A Russian Interior Ministry spokesman said security forces freed Herbert Gregg from the gunman who'd been holding him for ransom. Gregg wore a bandage on one hand where his captors had cut off one of his fingers to stress their willingness to kill him if the ransom wasn't paid. Russian officials have denied that any ransom money was paid. Gregg taught English at a university in the southern Muslim region of Dagestan near the border with Chechnya when he was abducted last November. Hackers have invaded the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration based in Norman, Oklahoma. It's one of the latest in a series of electronic attacks on high-profile government sites. Helen Papper reports from member station KGOU in Norman.
The National Storm Prediction Center is repairing its website after hackers vandalized it. Hackers, calling themselves Keebler Elves, broke into a computer for the National Severe Storms Laboratory. Director of the Norman Prediction Center, Joe Schaefer, says the attack stopped emergency management officials nationwide from checking forecasts for thunderstorms and tornadoes.
We put out weather forecasts that help people protect themselves and their property, and for someone to maliciously come in and delete the stuff just so they can say, hey, I did it, is really rather strange.
But Schaefer says he's pleased a part of their security system worked. He says the damage could have been much worse if the hackers had broken through the firewall and gotten to the main operating system. For NPR News, I'm Helen Papper in Norman, Oklahoma.
And this is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. William Karesh is a veterinarian whose patients live in the wild. He travels to the most remote parts of the world to diagnose and treat wild rhinos, buffalo, elephants, penguins. You get the point. He says, although the job sounds romantic, it's not one that most people would enjoy. It's arduous, uncomfortable, and sometimes dangerous. Dr. Karesh heads the International Field Veterinary Program for the Wildlife Conservation Society, which provides veterinary services all over the world for wildlife conservation projects. He's written a memoir called Appointment at the Ends of the World. When he's working with large wild animals, he has to sedate them first. It's not easy to sedate an elephant or a hippopotamus.
Probably the biggest challenge is getting close enough to dart them and have it safe for the team. Darts, there's a pretty widespread misconception with drug darts, and people, because the dart gun looks like a rifle, you just assume that it fires like a rifle. In fact, they're only good for maybe 30 or 40 yards at the most, as opposed to a high-powered rifle that can shoot, 200 yards without a problem. So to dart an animal effectively, and you want to make sure the dart ends up in a nice solid muscle mass, you just can't hit them anywhere, you have to get pretty close. And getting close to elephants or rhinos or hippos or any large animals can be fairly dangerous because they don't like people being so close to them.
You were once given this advice: if an elephant charges, don't run. Wait till the elephant is nearly upon you and then dodge to the side. Did you ever have an opportunity to use that advice?
No, and I'm not sure it's even very good advice. But I always keep it in the back of my head there as a backup plan. Generally, forest elephants, that was really referring to. And deep, when you're deep in the forest or the jungle, you can only see maybe 10 or 20 feet ahead of you, sometimes, if you're lucky, 30 feet. So when you find an elephant, they're extremely close. And elephants, of course, have adapted in the wild to respond to that also. And they know that any threats they have, which would usually be from a human, are going to be very close. So forest elephants do tend to charge you if you're suddenly upon them or you surprise them. If they hear you coming from a distance, and they have very good sense of hearing, or if they smell you, if the wind's behind you and they can smell you, they'll usually run away and not let you get close in the first place. But when you surprise them, they'll often will charge. And local people say, don't run, just hide, which I've certainly done in the past. I've been, hiding behind a tree with the elephant bashing on the other side of the tree, trying to, flush me out so I would run. But then also I work with some of the locals, like the Bayaka pygmies or the Mbuti pygmies, and they run like crazy when an elephant shows up, and they're very fast in the forest, so they get away. They manage to get away. I think I'm too clumsy to run that fast. So you're always wondering what it is to do.
So how long did you have to hide behind this tree?
Oh, it seemed like hours, but I think it was just a minute or two. And then the elephant finally got bored or frustrated and ran off into the forest.
There's a picture of you in your new book of you covering the eyes of a rhino after you've sedated the rhino with a dart. You're covering the rhino's eyes with a large cloth. How is covering the rhino's eyes helping to calm the animal until the sedation takes effect?
Well, a lot of the drugs we use, you know, only act on certain parts of the brain. And in the case of rhinos and the medication that we use to sedate them, they're in a very dreamlike state and they're unable to move physically. But they don't close their eyes, so covering their eyes, and we also put little earplugs in their ears made with socks stuffed with other socks. It just reduces some of the stimulation from outside, so it's almost a dreamlike state for them, and you don't want to surprise them or shock them, and it would be like almost arousing somebody in their sleep. Even though the drug makes it physically impossible, mentally we want to make sure they stay relaxed so it's not so traumatic for them. Also out in the blazing sun, we're working right on the equator, and if they're not blinking or their eyes aren't closed, we have to be worried about, you know, sun damage to the eyes. So that eye cover protects them not only from too much visual stimulation, but also just from the sun, so they don't end up with, you know, we don't want to cause a problem since we're really there trying to help these animals.
What kind of work were you doing with those rhinos?
With the rhinos, this was in northeastern Congo, Zaire, in a park called Garamba National Park. And we have a great team of people, biologists and veterinarians, actually, and we work together. There are only about 25 of this type of rhino left, the northern white rhino, only 25 or so left in the world, and they are all in this park. So what we're doing there is we're fitting those animals with radio collars, and later on we developed a horn transmitter where we could actually drill a hole in the horn of the rhino and insert a radio transmitter that operates on FM, just like this radio broadcast operates, and we could track those rhinos afterwards, and the park guards could actually follow the rhinos around and make sure they were protected from poachers.
And how has that program been working?
Well, it was great until the last two rebellions through the Congo, Congo Zaire. So it's very hard for the conservation workers to get in there and work. But sometimes they sneak in across the border and check up on things. And the park guards are still there. And it still looks pretty good for the rhinos. They've gotten pretty good protection. But we're always on the edge. It's right across the border from Sudan. And there's constant political unrest. So you never sleep well at night. There's no guarantees about what will happen in the future.
I guess that's just one example of how political problems can interfere with your work with wildlife.
Absolutely. I mean, we have to consider that whatever we're doing with wildlife conservation has to fit into the real world. And the real world involves a lot of human beings. And, of course, that means politics. So people's agendas are different. And sometimes in order for a politician or an individual to take control of their region or their country, they might have to put wildlife a little lower on their personal agenda. And so we try to stay, you know, apolitical so we can work with both sides. And certainly in that instance in Congo Zaire, we work very closely with whoever happens to be controlling the region, because it's somewhat irrelevant for the animals about who the actual political authority is. So we're kind of happy to work with whoever decides that they're in charge. And a lot of them understand that for the long term, they want their wildlife resources available. So there's not an instant change of heart. I think a good example is in Rwanda with the mountain gorillas. As governments change, they still recognize the value of the mountain gorillas. So they were kind of spared most of the fighting and the impact of the wars.
Have you or any of the conservationists you work with ever been attacked by militia members or, you know, other people involved in political warfare?
Well, I can't think of an example where anybody's been under direct fire. There were certainly stories I hear about the episode in Uganda in the spring with the guerrilla tourism is a horrible, horrible story. More often, we just get held up by militia or rebels. It doesn't happen very often, but then again, it's not uncommon to be stopped by military with rifles, and they want to go through your baggage and ask a lot of questions, and you try and explain what it is you're doing, and I've certainly been lucky always to be released unharmed. I've had some colleagues and friends that have been kidnapped in the forest by actually secessionists and people in the Congo Zaire forest that had not really had contact with the outside world for 25 years. And some of our teams going in to do survey work, you know, happened upon them, and there was a kingdom that none of us knew existed, and they were taken hostage by the king of the kingdom. But it was, they sent another person out for the ransom, and we ended up appointing the king as a wildlife advisor for the region, and he was very delighted by that and let our people go.
Tell me something more about the king.
It was a group, I think, they, during the 60s, when during, right after Zaire became independent and there was all the fighting, and ultimately, that time it was President Mobutu took control of the country. Some of these groups that had fled from villages to get away from the fighting had fled into the jungle about, you know, 20 to 30 miles from the nearest road, and just set up their own little world and never came back out to the road. So they were out in isolation essentially for 25, 28 years.
My guest is wildlife veterinarian Dr. William Karesh. He's written a memoir called Appointment at the Ends of the World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. William Karesh. He's the head of the Field Veterinary Program for the Wildlife Conservation Society, which is located at the Bronx Zoo. He's written a new memoir called Appointment at the Ends of the World, Memoirs of a Wildlife Veterinarian. When you're trying to assess the health of a colony of penguins, for instance, how do you do it? I mean, do you bring a stethoscope, take blood samples, stool samples?
We do all of that. The most important part before that is to link with the local government or the local conservation group to make sure that this is something they want done. And we're almost always invited in by foreign governments or foreign conservation organizations to assist them. And then it's just the logistical challenge of getting the proper equipment there, and set up. We can work in the field with a solar panel and a 12-volt battery and have a microscope and a centrifuge. And then you actually go into the colony with penguins. It's fairly easy to sneak up on a penguin and catch them by hand. And then you give them a physical exam, just like you would get a good complete physical if you went to your own personal doctor. And we take a blood sample and a stool or a fecal sample. And the blood samples we evaluate them in the field initially, but then we also freeze them in liquid nitrogen and bring them back for laboratory testing. And we'll look at a whole series of infectious diseases. We'll run a toxicology panel to see if they've been exposed to heavy metals or pesticides or PCBs. And then all of that data, those results, are combined then to give a profile for a given population.
What's the worst diagnosis you've had to give about an animal population that you've analyzed?
Well, we find a lot of important infectious diseases. Sometimes there are occasional die-offs. We've seen die-offs with swans in Patagonia from botulism, and it's not unlike the large die-offs you see in California, in the lakes of California, with waterfowl and botulism. There's also been anthrax outbreaks, which is a very deadly bacterial disease in wildlife in Africa, hippos, occasionally rhinos, buffalo. There's been tuberculosis. There's tuberculosis endemic in some of the parks in southern Africa. And we found tuberculosis and hepatitis in orangutans in Indonesia. So there's some potentially serious diseases. And then there's some other kind of low-grade chronic diseases, one called leptospirosis, which can infect humans, but we find it in antelope in Africa, and it can cause stillbirths or abortions in the antelope, sometimes high fever and even death on rare occasions, but it's contagious to humans, so we're concerned about the local people who hunt and eat these antelopes are also susceptible to getting these same diseases.
Well, let's get back to the tuberculosis and hepatitis that you found in the orangutan population. Once you diagnosed that the problem existed, did you do anything to treat it?
Well, the problem with treating tuberculosis in orangutans is that, much like humans, you can treat the disease and get it to sometimes go away, but more likely it remains in the animal or the human's body at a very low level or maybe sequestered off in a little nodule. Now, for humans, you would just say, well, that's fine, and every year you come back for a checkup, and we'll make sure the disease hasn't recrudesced or come back. The problem with orangutans is we can't ask them to come in for a checkup every year. So those animals, I certainly feel that those animals that are diagnosed with the tuberculosis, for example, they should be treated, but they can't be really put back into wild populations, because if the disease does come back into them, then they put these wild animals at risk. So we need to kind of have long-term care facilities or rest homes, whether it's a patch of forest somewhere where they can live but not put the wild populations at risk. Hepatitis, we don't know of a good treatment for in orangutans yet. There still needs to be some work on that.
What solution did you come up with for isolating the infected orangutans?
Well, the ones that are infected happen to be former pets, and this is not a natural disease. We went and looked at wild populations of orangutans, working with the Malaysian government. They're really great to work with, and found that none of these diseases exist in the wild populations, and that's why we feel so strongly about not releasing these infected animals. Now, these infected animals were former pets. There was a large pet trade in orangutans. The babies are very cute. People like to have them for pets, and they keep them in their homes, and that's how they develop diseases like tuberculosis and hepatitis from being exposed to humans. Now, those animals, because they are pets, they're comfortable being around people, so it's much easier to keep them in any kind of facility, whether it's a large island facility where they can range free, or maybe even, like I said before, a large patch of forest that's isolated from the wild populations. And I think those are good places to put those animals, and they're also great places where the general public can come and learn about orangutans. They can be nature centers or wildlife centers that serve an educational purpose. Since the animals are not very scared of people, they're easy to approach. You can see them climbing in the trees, and it's a great opportunity for them. And it's a nice life for the animals to be free in the trees and without risking these wild populations from the introduction of a disease that they have no resistance to.
You know, as a wildlife veterinarian, you travel around the world and, you know, you interact with animals large and small of all types. I wonder if your impressions of these animals and your reactions to them is often different from the impressions and the folklore of the people who actually live in the same area as the animals.
Yeah, absolutely. For one thing, I do, you know, I travel with my biases. And as a veterinarian, as a wildlife veterinarian, I'm already going in wanting to help the animals. And I have a natural awe for these animals. I have a great respect for them. I feel like the animals, you know, deserve to exist. And that's certainly partly from being a veterinarian. And then there's the whole North American or Western culture. We all come with that bias too. But it's certainly wrong to assume that people in other cultures and other countries feel the same way. And it's not a rude awakening, but I think it's an important awakening, and I am reminded of it constantly, that local people have developed their thoughts about animals in a very different way than we might have here. We're so lucky to have all the resources we have in our culture, and people in poorer areas are more exposed to animals. They have more reasons to be afraid of animals. They don't always have the same educational background that we have, so they, instead of that, they have to develop cultural histories or stories to explain why animals do some of the things they do. An interesting example has been with elephants and forest elephants. that a lot of local people I work with believe that many of the elephants are really humans transformed into elephants, and that villagers at night will transform themselves into elephants. So when you come across an elephant, it may not just be an elephant, it may actually be a person. And that puts that elephant, working with elephants, in a very different light when you consider that they may actually be people instead of elephants. Even high-ranking government officials in some countries, you know, believe this is true. This is the way they were raised, and who are we really to say it's not true?
Does this end up ever affecting how you interact with animals?
It does, because I think we have to respect some of the local feelings about animals, and we try to come to some level of agreement, some place where we can both achieve our goals when we're working with local populations in those situations. On the other hand, most cultural groups, most indigenous groups, are also very dependent on wildlife as a resource. And that helps us a lot, because they understand that we would like to help them ensure a future for wildlife. And that makes sense to them, because for their children and their children's children, they also want to make sure there is wildlife available for generations. So,
where are you off to next?
By the end of June, I have to be in Mongolia. It's calving season for gazelles, and we're trying to help with develop a management plan in the steppes, the eastern steppes of Mongolia. It's the largest, one of the largest unfenced grasslands left on the planet. And over a two-week period, maybe 500,000 gazelles will give birth. So we're going to go out and do little neonatal exams, just like taking your baby to the pediatrician, and collect blood samples. We're trying to develop a health profile for that population and integrate that into a management plan for them.
What kind of management plan?
Well, the gazelles are an important source of meat and skins for the Mongolians, and they do harvest them at certain times of year, but the harvesting has always been based on a best guess rather than knowing really how many animals reproduce every year and how many die naturally every year. So we'd try and get some good objective information and see that if their harvesting practices really make sense. A lot like hunting is done in the U.S., it's like white-tailed deer in the East Coast they try to base it on reproductive rates and population, so that they're continuing to be more, in this case, more gazelles. We don't want them hunted to extinction.
Dr. William Karesh heads the International Field Veterinary Program for the Wildlife Conservation Society. His memoir is called Appointment at the Ends of the World. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, anthropologist Craig Stanford, who studies mountain gorillas and chimpanzees in a Ugandan national park. He'll tell us about the impact of the attack last spring when Rwanda Hutu rebels massacred a group of tourists in the park. And pop critic Ken Tucker reviews Ron Sexsmith's new CD.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. About 300 rare mountain gorillas, that's about half of the world's surviving population, live in the Bwindi Impenetrable Forest National Park in Uganda. Dr. Craig Stanford is an anthropologist who studies gorillas and chimpanzees there. He hasn't been back to the park since a few days before the massacre of Western tourists last March. You probably heard part of the story. On March 1st, the park was attacked by about 100 members of the Hutu Intihamwe rebels, who were also behind the Rwandan genocide. They burned down many of the tourist camps, killed one of the park wardens, and kidnapped 14 people, mostly Western tourists who had paid to observe mountain gorillas. Stanford's field assistant was one of the hostages. The hostages were divided into two groups. One group was murdered. The other was allowed to live. Stanford's assistant survived. Craig Stanford teaches at the University of Southern California. I spoke to him from Los Angeles. He told me he found out about the attack shortly after he left Uganda and returned home.
I run a research project that has a small camp that's located about 8 miles into the forest away from the tourism center, Buhoma, where the attack happened. And so we stay there. I have some Ugandan field assistants who are permanently based there. And Mitchell Kiever was my current foreign research assistant coming from Calgary in Canada. I had left that camp, passing through the tourist camp, about 10 days earlier before the attack. And Mitch had actually taken me back to Kampala, and I had then flown home to L.A. And then I got an email on the morning of March 1st, because I get up during the night to work a lot on my computer, and I got an email about 4 in the morning from a colleague in Rwanda saying, just said, attack at Buhoma, no details right now, more later. And so that didn't tell me very much. I thought maybe it meant there was a bandit attack, you know, just somebody robbing the camp. And then that morning at breakfast, I was called by the Ottawa Foreign Affairs people, who are the equivalent of our State Department, telling me that they thought Mitch was a hostage, which I didn't believe, actually. I thought his agenda would have put him somewhere else that particular day. And then I called his mom and dad, who live on a farm outside of Calgary, and they said, no, we just talked to him on the phone, and in fact, he almost certainly was in that camp the night it was hit, or the morning it was hit. And so I then learned, actually later that day, Uganda time, but it was California time early in the morning on March 1st that he was a hostage.
So about half of the people taken hostage were murdered, and the other half were released. What condition was the part of the park that the attack took place and left in?
Well, my understanding, and again, I haven't been there since the attack. I was supposed to go back May 1st, and I canceled that trip because the security situation there isn't entirely clear. My understanding is that the camps, it's a dirt road. It's the termination of a long dirt road that you take to get to the park, and then the tourist lodges and the campgrounds and so forth are lined up alongside each side of the dirt road. Is that some of them were damaged and burned. The community campground, which is the $6 a night campground run by the local village folks for backpacking type tourists, that camp was burned. That was where Mitch was staying that night. And in general, the place was kind of ransacked and vehicles blown up and so forth.
This attack must have temporarily totally killed tourism in that area.
Yeah, what happened is that a moratorium was placed on tourism, I mean, an official ban on tourism to that park for 1 month. And, of course, it in the longer term is a terrible thing for Uganda's effort to develop themselves partly via ecotourism. Surprisingly, as soon as the ban on tourism was lifted a month later on April 1st, some tourists did return. The big tourist outfits, Abercrombie and Kent and some of the other safari companies left, and they may return later, but they haven't returned yet. But the more independent kind of travelers, backpackers, and so forth began coming back as soon as the park opened for tourism. Whether that was a smart thing for them to do or not is another question. But tourism has been terribly hurt, not only in Bwindi, the place where the attack happened, but really throughout Uganda. And it is a shame because Uganda, although many Americans, I think, still think of Uganda from the Idi Amin years 20 years ago, Uganda has done a really amazing job of developing, being very pro-West and developing, but not entirely at the expense of their natural resources. They have understood the value of protecting wildlife and wildlife sanctuaries and benefiting from the tourist interest in visiting those places.
Is the tourism good or bad for wildlife in Africa?
Well, yeah, I think that's a good question. For the mountain gorillas, which I'm most familiar with, I think that it's on the whole a good thing, with the proviso that there are many problems involved, and it's certainly a very insecure basis on which to try to protect the 600 remaining mountain gorillas in perpetuity. The reason being that in that part of the world where mountain gorillas still live, there are 300 which live in the Virunga Volcanoes Conservation Area, which is mainly in Rwanda, and then there are 300 in Windi, which is entirely within Uganda. It's one of the most biologically fascinating and at the same time politically messed up places on Earth. And that means that any effort to protect the gorilla that assumes that ecotourism dollars will be there, and tourists, when they come to see the gorillas at Windi, at least before the attack, were paying up to $240 for a gorilla viewing permit, meaning $240 to spend 1 hour with the gorillas, and a maximum of about 12 to 14 tourists per day were paying that. So it's a lot of money, not to mention all the ancillary money that's laid out. And 20% of that permit fee goes to local villages. So the economic incentive for local people to protect the gorillas, to not harass them, not kill them, not cut down the forest, it was great. And without the tourism, of course, that incentive is removed. And since it all relied on tourism, the conservation effort, I think we realize now that it's not a very stable basis for protecting a critically endangered wildlife species.
Your work in the park is studying chimps and gorillas, and I'm wondering if the chimps and gorillas have been killed or injured during these wars in that part of Africa.
Well, certainly in the Virunga Volcanoes in Rwanda, poaching was an enormous problem back in Diane Fossey's day, meaning poaching for either to get baby gorillas to try to sell to some zoo or something like that, or else poaching for the horrible souvenir trade, meaning to make ashtrays and so forth out of gorilla hands. But death through wars, in the genocidal war in Rwanda in 94, one of the ironies was, regarding wildlife, that something like 800,000 people died and only five gorillas were known to have been killed due directly or indirectly to the military action that was going on there. And that may be partly because both sides, the army and the rebels, recognized that whoever controlled Rwanda would want the tourism dollars that the guerrillas could bring in. So the wars per se don't necessarily kill guerrillas or devastate the guerrilla habitat, but certainly all of the other things were connected to the war, all of the instability that's spread by the war that keeps conservation effort at a minimum or keeps tourism away is just awful for the guerrillas. And recently there's been a terrible problem, of course, with refugees going through the forest in the Virungas and trashing the habitat and things like that.
The park in Bawindi, in which you operate, the park that was also the site of the tourist attack, is in southwestern Uganda. What is the importance of this park environmentally and for the gorillas that live there?
Well, Bawindi is just an absolutely amazing place. And I think most people who have heard of Bawindi or who heard of it before the attack knew it as the place to go see mountain gorillas, and it's been featured in lots of travel sections of major newspapers and so forth. But really, the gorillas may be the most visible wildlife and the most attention-attracting wildlife, but Bawindi is just a tremendous natural treasure for all of Africa and really for the entire world. It's on UNESCO's list of World Heritage Sites, and it's a place that has an extremely high level of species endemism, meaning species that are found nowhere else or almost nowhere else except this 300 and some square kilometer forest. So there are many birds, for instance, that live in the forest at Bawindi that are found in only one or two other forests in the world, and their main breeding populations are in Bawindi. It's a very rugged, high-altitude tropical forest. It's 8,000 feet maximum elevation. It's a chilly place. It's not a classic lowland rainforest at all. And there are very few mountainous rainforests left in Africa. So protecting it, not just the gorillas, but all of the wildlife, all the plants and animals, really is a major goal for all the conservation organizations. And losing it, either through loss of the forest or loss of the wildlife, is just an enormous loss for humanity.
And what does it have to be protected from? From developers and from war?
Well, the 300 square kilometers that remain are there only because local people having deforested the area around it. I mean, it's basically an island that sits in the middle of a human sea today. It needs to be protected from further forest cutting, that is, from poaching of the trees that are within the park boundary. The wildlife need to be protected from poaching. There are very few, actually, species of the larger hoofed animals. There's a very small herd of elephant remaining. There are small populations of antelope and so forth, but there has been a lot of poaching over the years of those animals just by local people for food. So the conservation effort kind of uses gorillas as a flagship animal, but is aimed at protecting the entire forest. And, of course, that's an enormous job. People are hungry. People are very poor. People have very little land for their farms and their families. And so the gorillas were useful for the conservation effort. They still are. Not only to protect them for their own intrinsic value, but also to use them as a flagship to protect the entire forest.
Do a lot of people who live in that area resent the attention that wildlife is getting when the people themselves are so poor and in such need of attention?
Well, I think that would definitely be true if it weren't that tourism dollars that have been coming in were partly given to the local communities. So 20% of every gorilla permit, 20% of every $240 permit went to local villages. So if you walk to a village that's within a few miles of Windy, that village today will have a dispensary or will have some kind of agricultural project going on that wouldn't exist except for the gorilla tourism. And local people, you know, extremely rational, as anybody would be, and they realize that there's a real economic incentive here to not harming the gorillas and to not going in and trashing and cutting down the forest. So, again, another way in which tourism has been very valuable there.
Was tourism basically the only source of income for some of the villages that got tourism dollars?
Well, what happened is that the villages around Windy received an economic windfall when tourism began because 20% of the gorilla permit fees began going to those local villages. And those villages over time became pretty dependent on tourism money. So my concern about that area is not only the gorillas, but also that those villages now are destitute because the tourism dollars are going to disappear and so will the percentage going to them. So those villages are farming villages primarily, but I believe that there are an awful lot of people there who did become dependent on tourism, and people were drawn to the area to work as porters, to work in shops and so forth, and to work in jobs connected to the tourist industry. So in that sense, they are quite dependent.
My guest is anthropologist Craig Stanford. He studies mountain gorillas and chimpanzees in a national park in Uganda. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is anthropologist Craig Stanford. He studies mountain gorillas and chimpanzees in the Ugandan National Park where a group of Western tourists were massacred last March. Will you describe the research that you're doing with chimpanzees and gorillas?
Yeah, what we've been doing for the past 3 years, and I have a history over the past decade of working with chimps in different parts of Africa. I came to Bwindi 3 years ago to set up a project that we call the Bwindi Impenetrable Grade 8 Project, and it looks at the relationship between chimpanzees and mountain gorillas. And one of the things that Bwindi is unique for is that it's the only forest on the African continent where you have both mountain gorillas and chimpanzees. And there are many other forests in Africa where you have one or the other, or where you have lowland gorillas and chimpanzees. But Bwindi is the only place where you have these two great apes living in the same forest and sharing the same resources. And so we've been investigating and trying to figure out what's the relationship. Do they compete for food? Some people, we haven't seen this yet, some people have seen gorillas and chimps in the same tree, which is, I'm sure, a spectacular sight, a 400-pound silverback gorilla and chimpanzees way up in the same tree canopy. And do they compete for nesting spots and this sort of thing? And that's an intrinsically interesting set of questions, and then it's also useful for the conservation effort in terms of learning more about Bwindi gorillas. Bwindi is about 30 miles from the Virunga volcanoes. In between the two forests, there's just farmland, so the gorillas from the two forest areas don't migrate across. They're isolated. And the Virungas is where Diane Fossey and all of her students who followed her did their famous work back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And so there's a huge database from the Virungas on what those mountain gorillas are all about. the other half of the world's mountain gorillas that live in Windy, we still know very, very little about. So the project is aimed at understanding the gorillas themselves and also looking at the relationship between the chimps and the gorillas.
What are the big questions that you really want to know the answers to?
Regarding the chimps and the gorillas?
Yeah.
I would say the two sets of questions are, first of all, I'm an anthropologist, and so my career is about trying to reconstruct elements of early human life. And the fascinating thing about Windy from that perspective is that we know that some of the earliest important things that happened in human evolution happened right in the same geographic area where Windy is located, right at the western edge of the Great Rift Valley in East Africa. And we know that there were times earlier in our history when there would be multiple, two, three, or more species of early human living in the same place at the same time, which, of course, doesn't exist today. So looking at two great apes that live in the same forest, sharing the same resources, is a study that may give us some insight into the relationship among early human ancestors who also had to share the same resources. And then the other part of the research, and actually the reason that I went there and just fell in love with the place and decided I had to be involved in the research effort in some way, is that it's just a spectacularly beautiful and spectacularly interesting ecosystem. As I said, it's a rugged, high mountain range with tropical forest all across it, and the ecosystem itself is fascinating. You could spend many lifetimes trying to learn about the relationships between the plants and animals in this forest. It's kind of the Yellowstone for the African continent. And so given that there has been a very small research presence there over the last couple of decades, it's just an absolutely wonderful place to go and just learn about the world.
When do you think you might feel that it's safe for you to return to Bwindi and resume your research with the chimps and gorillas?
Well, I canceled this trip because the security situation was really just not clear. And in fact, I had originally planned to have my family and my three small children there with me just about the time of the attack, and I'm glad it didn't work out that way. As for the future, I'm planning to go back at the end of this year and move the camp that I've built to the other side of the park, about 30 miles away, to an area that is much more secure where we have other researchers who have gone back and are continuing their work, and there's kind of a research headquarters there. But to be honest, I'm not convinced right now, and I'm not there, so I can't say firsthand, but I'm not convinced that the security situation is going to be better in the long term, because the rebels who attacked, in fact, about 2 weeks before the attack, my assistant and I were sitting around the camp one night talking about the fact that these rebels were just across the border, that we knew they were there, that the Ugandan army knew they were there, and no one believed that they were organized enough to form a militia that would then attack Buhoma, this major settlement that was guarded by park rangers with rifles and so forth. So we knew the people were there. They're still there. There are something like 10 to 20,000 in Terahamwe who were ejected from Rwanda after the civil war there in 94 and are now living scattered around eastern Congo across the border from Uganda. So that situation isn't going to change anytime soon. And I have to say that I think that the situation is going to be unstable there for the near term, maybe the long-term future. That's kind of the way that East Central Africa has been for the last decade or so.
Was this a concern of yours when you first went to the park in 1996 to begin your research?
Well, actually, no, because first, we hadn't had any history of any rebel incursions in that part of Uganda. And only later, when I was working there in the camp that we built, as I said, it's about 8 kilometers from the tourist center, and it's only about 5 kilometers, so 3 miles or so from the border with Congo. So it's right on the border. And we started hearing about attacks that these Interahamwe rebels, who were living as a kind of a ragtag army scattered through different settlements on the Congo side, were launching attacks across the border into Uganda and raiding villages and taking supplies and occasionally killing someone or burning down a house. And they were doing it really just as bandits who had nothing to eat and had no supplies. So we didn't really think of them as being potentially a paramilitary force that would stage a major incursion that would include, you know, kidnapping or killing. We worried about robberies. And it makes me think twice about setting the project up again, but it's one of those things that the State Department had no travel advisory issued for that part of Uganda, which is unusual considering that they often have advisories issued for places that researchers who live there know to be really quite safe. I mean, I have to say that my perspective on safety in Windy is relative, because I feel, having lived in Africa and other developing parts of the world for many years, that living in rural Africa is on the whole a lot safer than living in most American cities. I mean, I live very close to L.A., and I certainly feel safer living in rural Africa than I feel just walking around the streets of any urban area in the U.S. It's like living in a small farming community when you're in rural Africa. And, of course, what changes that is when you have warfare or these kinds of rebel movements going on.
Well, Craig Stanford, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
And good luck when you return to Africa.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Craig Stanford teaches anthropology at the University of Southern California. He studies mountain gorillas and chimpanzees at a national park in Uganda. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Ron Sexsmith's new CD. This is Fresh Air. Ron Sexsmith is a Canadian singer and songwriter in his 30s. Over the past few years, he's become a favorite among critics, including our rock critic, Ken Tucker. Sexsmith has a new CD called Whereabouts, which finds him making the sort of carefully crafted music that sustains a reputation, if not big record sales. Ken has a review.
His sour phrasing and a face that looks like a ripe plum with a Beatles haircut, Ron Sexsmith is the embodiment of fruity melancholy, and I love the guy for it. There aren't many musicians around willing to be so boldly wimpy, so unabashedly dependent upon the object of his affection. Listen to him beg for it on Right About Now.
When the world is wearing me down, and the wind is thrown its way around, so cold it blows right through me. I need your love. I so could use your love right about now.
The same. Ron Sexsmith is mannerly and precise, both Canadian traits, if you'll permit national stereotypes. When he sings in a tune called Riverbed, "Never said I'd be your superhero, never said I'd be strong," he's not being unduly modest. Sexsmith's music takes its strength from its author's lyrical vulnerability. His material rarely sounds spineless or soggy because he has such a sure sense of melody and narrative. It also helps that he enlists aid from producers like Mitchell Froom and Chad Blake, who've worked with acts ranging from Elvis Costello to Randy Newman, and who surround him with just the right amount of musical ornamentation, from plaintive banjos to zinging violins.
Riverbed, I'll lay my head upon your pillow and watch the waves go flowing by. Riverbed, underneath the weeping willow, I'll sleep until the sunlight fills the sky. Never said could be your superhero. I never said that I was strong. Riverbed,
like everything else about Sexsmith's work, I think the title of this CD is very deliberately thought through. Whereabouts. It's a slightly old-fashioned word, rarely used conversationally these days, and it suggests the singer's primary concern, locating himself in the world, trying to figure out where he fits in. This is expressed most decisively on the collection's best, most straightforward song, Beautiful View.
If I had all
Ron Sexsmith is, I'm afraid, one of those guys destined to fall between the cracks in America. The baby boomers who would most naturally enjoy his music, hear its roots in early Jackson Brown and the Kinks' Ray Davies, will probably never become aware of him in sizable numbers. And post-baby boomers, well, why should they care about Sexsmith's wistful maturity and hard-won ambivalence? Working in a form that prizes force and momentum, Ron Sexsmith is gloriously vague.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Ron Sexsmith's new CD, Whereabouts. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Kathy Wolf. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
You can count on many things to let you down. You can take your plans, stick 'em 6 feet underground. Wouldn't your time be better spent on days to come, not the ones that went and left you on a doorstep one gray morning? There's a rumor and everybody's so convinced, but you don't believe.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, publishers of Bombay Ice by Leslie Forbes, a novel of psychological suspense set in India. Available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the first woman of the Navajo tribe to become a surgeon, Dr. Lori Arviso Alvord, and we talk with Kevin Bales, who has traveled through Africa and Asia reporting on contemporary slavery. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.